retreat is nearly complete. As many of you know, that term session means touch the heart of things. So that's what we've been doing, and I hope that our appreciation of that is more refined now. This lack of refinement that characterizes a lot of sentient being life is kind of a problem. Because as a result, even though reality is beating us over the head 24/7, as they say, we kind of don't notice. Eons of karmic habit have kind of dulled our senses. So to have a practice that allows basic sanity to manifest, that allows the natural function of the body-mind to manifest, is a powerful corrective. Sort of like getting Rolfed, which not something I would do myself, but I understand it's, you know, rather uncomfortable. Yeah, I'm told it's rather involves a lot of exertion of pressure of various kinds. So our practice sometimes is like that, you know. Moving in accord with reality, kind of instead of habit, can be quite uncomfortable. If this were Tassajara or something, and people are all keyed up from training period and sesshin. Like, wait a minute, isn't habit reality too? It's like, yeah, habit's reality too. And if that's your realization, very good. But habit's also habit. And the habit body and the reality body are not two, but it's best not to mistake one for the other. So the identity, in a sense, the not-two-ness of the habit and reality body is kind of the heart of the practice. That's the shin of seshin that we touch. Se also means to gather up. So we kind of gather ourselves bodily, gather the body mind, muster the body mind, as Dogen says, and inhabit and express the not-to-ness of habit and reality. And it's a little uncomfortable. We also declare that people have been doing just this practice for a very long time. Probably kalpas, but anyway, as far as our human world is concerned, we would say, you know, a couple of millennia and a half. At the very least, since Shakyamuni Buddha woke up. In East Asia, they chose the 8th of December as the day to celebrate that phenomenal arising. Here at One Mountain Temple, we're celebrating it on the 6th, giving the drop on billions of East Asians. And in this celebration, we are honoring our family, our Buddha family, our lineage, our bloodline, which carries this practice, has carried this practice for this long, long time. It's it can be good to review the story a little bit, you know. Shakyamuni went through some difficulties, learned some techniques of meditation as they were understood in those days. I hung out with some people who did those practices. Found them kind of interesting because they expanded the experience of reality from its habitual focus on survival and success. Of course, a decent LSD trip will do that too. So there's various ways, but anyway, it's not reported that Shakyamuni took LSD. But he did this other stuff and spent some years at it, and some of the people he hung out with, you know, they're still around, not necessarily embodied identically, but if you go to India, I actually haven't been there yet, but many people have said a lot of the ascetical practices that were known even in Buddhist time are still around. Some of them of puzzling severity. One of the forms of ascetic practice, you know, is you hold your arm in the air permanently until it withers. And you'll still see people who have undertaken that practice, or people who, there's a mudra, I don't know if I can do it anymore, for use at, in, let's see, how do you do that? For use in staring at the sun. I think I can still do it. You use this mudra, and you stare at Surya, the sun, until one of your eyes goes blind. Personally, I don't think that's so attractive, but they were doing stuff like that in Buddha's day, and some people still do. So Buddha did some of that stuff. You know, he starved himself almost to death. And in so doing, concluded that that sort of stuff was not very helpful. He had also come from a life of extreme pleasure and abundance, kind of like most of us do. Now, we may not think of our life that way, but I don't think Shakyamuni did either. It was just, that's how it was. Pretty much whatever he wanted, he could get. Except we can get a lot of things he could not get. And compared to how much of the world lives, we live lives of abundance and luxury. So Shakyamuni also had found that that wasn't very helpful either. And hence, he came up with the middle way. Which expresses itself again and again in his teaching. And so, I don't know, sometimes it seems like in certain expressions of practice, it gets forgotten about. When I was at university, there were some Western Buddhists who had received ordination in one of the ordination traditions, and they did, some of them did stuff like they lived in a little hut on the roof of their building, here in town. Kind of open, little, like a crate, like some of our homeless do, except the homeless often don't have a choice. Or they vowed to eat one grain of rice a day. Or they vowed never to lie down. And I asked one of these ordained persons was teaching a class that I was in. So I asked her once. It was a little hard to talk to her because she'd never look at me. And I think that's because I was a guy and she was a big shuni. So she'd always look over there and I'd be talking to her. She's looking over there. Okay. So I asked her, didn't Buddha kind of like say that stuff's not useful? And honestly, I can't remember the answer as being very satisfactory or amounting to much of anything. Something along the lines of, well, we can talk about that more later. And we never did. But this, the heart of the middle way is extremely important in this practice. Because if you stray from it, you're either indulging or you're abusing. And to find that part in this practice, as Shakyamuni conveyed it to us, is something we should constantly keep in mind. Now, some say, well, we're so crummy and stupid and encrusted with ancient twisted karma that we have to do things that are a lot worse than anybody in Shakyamuni's time. Personally, I think that's not so. I think we're very like people in Shakyamuni's time. Obviously, there's some differences, but reality has not changed very much. So it was after Shakyamuni encountered and practiced, and if you like, received the revelation from I don't know where, of the middle way, that he sat down and did his unique practice, which we say is, well, that's what we do. Of course, we would say that. His unique practice was taking a seat, taking the diamond seat in reality. And that's all. That practice is so naked that it's frightening to people sometimes. So sometimes it's kind of wrapped up in packaging. Kind of like I wrapped the Shakyamuni figure there on the altar. It's kind of wrapped up so that it's not quite so intimidating. And the wrapping looks like stuff like, you could do that practice maybe eventually, but you have to do these others first. That's, strictly speaking, an upaya, right? This is, that word means something skillful. In order to help people find a way to practice in spite of themselves, in spite of their objections and reservations, in spite of their maybe kind of bad opinion of themselves, in spite of the error of thinking that Buddhas and sentient beings are two different things. So it's like, well, if they think that, we'll say, well, you're just this sentient being. Here's a ladder you can climb up, and after many incalculable eons, you'll be a Buddha. One of the consequences of Buddha's practice was the discovery that the ladder also is empty and leads nowhere other than here. So, in one of those waves of not reform exactly, re-inspiration that periodically emerges in the human spiritual sphere, some people said, well, let's throw out all this stuff. Let's get rid of, you know, all ancillary elements and return to or manifest Buddha's actual practice. So, as the stories say, Buddha sat down under a tree and the world kind of tried to roll over him. And the temptation to see phenomena as separate from a self just got overwhelming. And they call that Mara. You know, the evil one, the tempting and confusing one, came to Shakyamuni and made a lot of trouble. So a Buddha decided that he wasn't going to go anywhere until he had resolved this great matter. And of course some people think, well, that means he didn't even get up. He just, for 49 days, he didn't even have to pee. I'm like, I don't think so. That's another pious fraud. He probably had to pee and ate some and maybe even lay down a little bit, like us. But eventually, do you know what Mara's final challenge was? You ought to, because I've said this before.
Said you don't have the right. You don't have the. Who are you?
Who are you to sit there? Buddha said, "Well, let me ask my mom." And mom said, "Go for it, sonny." And so Mara slank away, slunk off. And that was the last he was seen. So, who are you to sit there is, the final challenge for all of us. If we give way to the temptation to kind of crumple into doubt in the face of that challenge, we will be missing something precious. So as this practice was presented to us, we're instructed to how to sit and call the earth to witness. And so, how do you do that? How do we touch the earth? As I said before, once and for all, moment after moment. Anybody? What is the Bhumi Sparsha? Touching the earth. What is that?
You said it very nicely this morning.
What did I say?
Don't see phenomena as a self.
Yeah. Another way to say that is just this body-mind, now. that is touching our mother, the earth. And after a time, actual and constant dawning of reality became clear, symbolized by the morning star. So maybe Shakyamuni did see a morning star, but even if he didn't, he knew reality. An amazing place, reality. Quite amazing. That's where we live. So if we're not amazed, maybe, you know, we're not paying such good attention. Anyway, for a while, Shakyamuni was amazed enough just to kind of wander around, going, wow, man, what a trip. And then some people came and said, what are you on? And he said, nothing, just I'm digging reality. And they said, well, will you tell us about that? And he said, nah. And they said, please. And he said, nah, I can't, forget it. I can't talk about this. They said, come on, give it a shot. And he said, oh, all right. First thing is, avoid the two extremes. So I hope you've successfully avoided the two extremes this retreat, and you will help me in my practice going forward, trying to do that, make that effort to clarify and touch the earth over and over again, to take the diamond seat in reality, and let the clouds come and go. And let your faith be so complete that there is nowhere in your body mind that does not reach. That may sound like something you're supposed to cook up, but that's not what I mean. That's what Dogen calls non-thinking. That's what he calls stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. Stop! Just give it up. As Suzuki Roshi said, just to be alive is enough. And embodying that over and over again is not separable from realization. So there's our morning star. Please go on and admire it. And please take your seat in reality over and over again. And, you know, help others too by doing that. Drop by the temple sometime and do that with us. You can do it anywhere, I know that, but drop by. Practice with others. When Suzuki Roshi told people, sit when everybody else sits. It was kind of a community practical instruction, but there's also a great truth there. When I lived here before, I was thinking last night, I lived up on the third floor in the room Michael's in now, and this wild and crazy guy lived across the hall from me, and his practice was cleaning the Zendo floor every Saturday. So, okay, that's pretty good. He didn't often come to Zazen, but he cleaned the Zendo floor every Saturday. I thought, okay, well, that's pretty good. And then another guy who lived here a little later, periodically he'd stalk up to me and say, I'm sitting Sesshin by myself in the Zendo for the next 5 days. Okay. Periodically you'd hear little bells being rung down here. Okay, I don't get it, but yeah, all right, whatever. That kind of cave practice, I was not introduced to that and I'm not interested in it. I like practicing with others. So thank you for joining this practice of touching life, touching heart. And please be encouraged. Let the encouragement continue. And please don't be fooled when the causes and conditions of your life shift, as they will, you know, pretty soon now, and your mind will be different. So don't freak out. And that happens. Don't think, what? That was reality before, and now it's just crummy. It's like, that is very weak practice. Don't do that. That is very weak faith. I like Sojin Roshi's approach to Sesshin, or the end of Sesshin, where he says, Sesshin? What's Sesshin? That's it. It's gone. Don't look back. It's gone. Just keep practice in your heart. So, we'll have time for a little more Zazen, which we all love desperately. And then we'll have a little ceremony. And then a little, I think, lasagna. So, and then who knows after that?
Laundry.
Beyond any doubt, there will be a line for the washer.